Hello everyone, and welcome to Ask Margot Today, where I look forward to answering your sticky questions about life. Anything that keeps you feeling small, feeling sick or stuck. I'm Margot de Coatsworth. One of the areas I specialise in my work is around how we can achieve perfect health. Perfect health being the aspiration, of course, and the achieving part being the actual journey to get what we aspire to. You may wonder why I'm interested in such a lofty aspiration. How do we actually achieve such a thing? What I feel strongly about in life is that we are not designed to be subject to life, but to be the choosers and the directors of our life. Sometimes this seems an impossible feat, but it's an interesting question to ask of ourselves. What is it we think we are designed for? What is it that we are capable of, and what's our true potential? I think it's a whole lot more than we have been led to believe and how we've lived our lives. We can stop by saying, what if I have more power than I thought? What if my rights are greater than I thought? What if I'm designed for more than I've actually thought possible for me? Then go even one step further and say, what if it all starts in me, in my mind, in my thinking, in the story I tell and the words I use? What if my body is not in charge? What if my mind is in charge? I guess that's what we explore here on this show when we look at things like health. How can we use our minds to influence our bodies? For a long time, we've treated the mind and the body as two separate systems. I certainly did. I recall saying, my body does its thing and I do mine. I was wrong. We thought the body was mechanical and the mind was psychological. We treat one with drugs and procedures and the other with therapy and coping strategies. Now we understand more. Over the past decades, research across neuroscience, immunology, and behavioral medicine has established something far more integrated. The mind and the body are in constant biochemical conversation. Your thoughts do not simply stay in your head, they become signals. But what the science makes clear is this: the mind is not merely observing the body, it's participating in its regulation. Thoughts influence chemistry. Chemistry influences cellular behavior, and cellular behavior influences your health outcomes. In other words, the mind can tell the body what to do. The question is whether we are aware of the instructions we're giving. Perfect health begins with recognizing that relationship and learning to participate in it deliberately. Your body is listening and your language is instruction. This is life-changing information. I find it absolutely thrilling. Helping people to understand and apply this is exactly what I do inside my Perfect Health Hub. You can email me if you'd like more of this kind of direction or support, because it's hard to find. But now we must answer some questions. Our first question today is from Lulu. Margot, she says, what can you do when you're not feeling good, when you're feeling anxious, depressed, maybe even hopeless? Sometimes it feels as though life or a situation has closed in around us. How do you change that state? I think this is something everyone experiences at some point. There are days when your mind spirals, when circumstances feel heavy, when you wake up with a knot in your stomach and the world seems to have narrowed into a small and discouraging place. And when you're in that state, the danger is that the mind keeps feeding itself the same material. You know what I mean? One negative thought produces another. One worry leads to the next, and we're in a loop of tension. The first thing to understand is that your emotional state is not fixed. It's fluid, it can change. And one of the most powerful ways to change it is through deliberate gratitude. I don't mean polite gratitude. I mean active, proactive gratitude, an unrelenting flood of thank yous. I do this myself. When you feel yourself sinking into anxiety or hopelessness, begin by saying thank you, out loud if you can, for every single thing you can think of. Thank you for the roof over your head. Thank you for the food in your fridge. Thank you for the friend who checked in last week. Thank you for the sunshine this morning. Thank you for the book you enjoyed. Thank you for the strength you have. Thank you for your breath. The key is, do not leave space between the thank yous. Keep them coming, one after another, because when you do this, two things happen simultaneously. First, the mind shifts focus. It cannot dwell on despair while it's actively searching for things to appreciate. The brain begins scanning for evidence of goodness rather than evidence of threat. Secondly, the body responds. Gratitude has measurable physiological effects. It reduces stress hormones, supports the parasympathetic nervous system, the body's calming response, and increases feelings of connection and safety. The mind changes the chemistry, and the chemistry changes the mood. But there's another dimension as well. When you express gratitude, you are acknowledging abundance rather than lack. You are directing your attention towards what's working rather than what's broken. That shift in attention changes your relationship with life. The purpose of this exercise is not to force yourself into artificial happiness, although that doesn't sound like a bad idea to me as a stopgap. It's to change your state. When you keep expressing gratitude without leaving gaps between the thank yous, something interesting happens. The list becomes long, then longer. Soon you realize you are overwhelmed, not by what's missing, but by what's already present. And the emotional state shifts. You feel lighter. You breathe more easily. Perspective returns. The situation you were worrying about may still exist, but you are no longer drowning in it. Gratitude does not deny difficulty. It restores balance. It reminds you that life is larger than the moment you're struggling with. At once your state changes, your thinking becomes clearer, your nervous system settles. Possibilities that were invisible a few minutes earlier begin to appear. So the next time you feel anxious, depressed, or hopeless, try this. Begin saying thank you. Do not stop. Do not pause. Do not leave space for old thoughts to creep back in. Just keep going until gratitude fills the whole room of your mind. Because when gratitude takes the space, despair cannot stay there. Remember, the first thought that pops into your head may not be a good one, but only you and only you get to choose what your second thought is going to be. Are you going to follow that first unwanted thought down the rabbit hole? Or are you going to say, I don't think so, not today. And then off you go to play your thank you game. This is your life. You get to choose. You are the genie. You are the one who has the power to grant your own wishes, Lulu. This question actually leads us beautifully into our next one. Margot, we often hear the phrase tough love, usually in the context of how we deal with someone else, a child, a partner, or a friend who needs firmer boundaries. But can tough love also apply to ourselves? The answer from me is absolutely yes, and actually that's where it should begin. Traditionally, tough love refers to caring about someone enough to hold a firm line with them. It means refusing to enable behaviour that's damaging, even when compassion is present. A parent might apply tough love to a child by setting clear limits. A friend might apply it by refusing to support destructive choices. But we rarely turn that principle inward to ourselves. We're often very disciplined about correcting others, yet strangely permissive with ourselves. And that's where self-directed tough love becomes important. Self-directed tough love simply means this: caring enough about your life that you hold yourself to the standards you say you believe in. If you say you want good health, then tough love may mean being honest about your eating habits. It may mean deciding that food that you put into your body should support your energy rather than sabotage it. If you're eating more than you're burning, something needs to be addressed. If you say you want mental clarity and emotional steadiness, then tough love may be required. Going to bed at a sensible time, getting up when you said you would, not letting yourself off the hook in the morning. It may involve just what we talked about. What thoughts are you allowing to dominate you? What's the story you're telling? If you say you want better relationships, tough love may mean keeping in touch with the people who matter, sending the message, making the call, not drifting into neglect simply because life becomes busy or because you think they should or will take the initiative. Sometimes tough love means addressing behaviours that quietly undermine us, drinking too much, avoiding responsibilities, living in disorganisation, postponing things we know need our attention. Because at the centre of all of this is responsibility. The buck does stop with us. There is a dance in life between what is ours to do and what belongs to something larger, greater, whether you call that life, the universe, or God. But there are certain things that clearly fall into our domain. I often think people pray and say, my prayers aren't working. But maybe that is because they're asking God to do something for them that God has designed them to do for themselves. God is not going to do the things for us that we're supposed to be doing ourselves. We're given agency. We're given the ability to choose. We're given the capacity to direct our behavior. So when we find ourselves wishing for better circumstances, we need to ask, is this something I should be praying about or something I should simply be doing? Tough love towards yourself means closing the gap between what you say you want and how you are living. And the amazing thing is this, when you begin to practice that kind of honesty with yourself and accountability, your self-respect grows with it. Because once you recognize what's your responsibility, you no longer wait for change to arrive from outside of you. You begin creating it. You can always make a game of it. Be your own sergeant major. Say to yourself, you will make your bed perfectly every day, and I'll be checking on you. Just pick one thing in your life and begin with it. Our next question is from a listener, James, who says, in a world that's constantly talking about success, achievement, and accumulation, what really matters in the end? What should we be focusing our energy on? I'm a bit sick of the superficiality I see around me all the time. I hear you, James, and there's one word. It is connection. At the end of the day, and certainly at the end of a life, connection is what's mattered most. Not the house, not the bank account, not even the accolades. People, our family, if we have one, or our friends who become like family, if that's how our lives have unfolded. Human beings are wired for connection. That's not simply sentimental language. It is a biological reality. Our nervous system is designed to regulate itself through safe, trusting relationships. When we feel connected, supported, and known, the body settles, stress chemistry reduces. Loneliness, on the other hand, has been shown repeatedly to affect health in profound ways. We actually live longer when we have good connections because we are built for belonging. And yet, we're encouraged to pursue success, to accumulate, to build, to gather things that signify achievement. Sometimes I observe auctions and watch the contents of someone's home being sold. Furniture, art, collections, objects that someone has chosen carefully and invested in and spent their energy collecting. In many cases, it's a whole estate, the material record of someone's life. I often find myself thinking, that was their life. I hope they enjoyed those things. I hope they brought satisfaction while they were a part of that person's daily world. But in the end, everything has gone under the hammer. And that's a powerful reminder. The things we spend so much energy acquiring eventually become just things again. Connection does not. The time you spent listening to your child, encouraging them, shaping their confidence, that continues through them. The friend you stood beside when life was difficult remembers that always. The conversations, the shared meals, the laughter, the small gestures of loyalty and kindness, these do not go to auction. They live on in memory and in character and in the people who carry those experiences forward, probably to future generations. There is a wonderful line attributed to C.S. Lewis about legacy. He says, "Our legacy is not simply what we build in the world, but what we build in the people around us, especially our children." Because influence lasts longer than possession. Character lasts longer than objects, and love lasts longer than wealth. That doesn't mean success is wrong. Building things, creating value, achieving goals are admirable and worthwhile pursuits. I do think we are wired for those. But they should never outrank people. The real investments of a life are relational. How you treated the people close to you. Those are the things that remain. So it's worth asking ourselves from time to time, where is my energy going? Am I investing in things that will eventually be catalogued and sold? Or am I investing in people who will carry something of me forward? Because the truth is very simple. The things you own will one day belong to someone else. But the love you gave, the encouragement you offered, the character you helped shape, that stays on to do good. So if you want to build something lasting, build people. They're the only legacy that never goes to auction. I hope that answers your question, James. The answer to this last question is something I wish I'd done with my children because I think the principles it teaches are amazing. Julie said, "How do we teach children about money properly? Many adults struggle with it themselves, so how can parents give their children a healthy relationship with earning, spending, and saving?" This is such an important question because our relationship with money usually begins in childhood, whether we realize it or not. And if the story we heard around money from our parents was an erroneous one, it takes a lot of work to undo that often. Wouldn't it be cool if we got it right from the beginning and that we taught our children things that are really going to set them on a path, if not just to financial success, but to freedom from the burden of not having enough and not being able to take care of themselves and their families? That is an awful thing. So everybody listen to this because it's really very important. I came across the concept just recently. Lots of us give money to children without teaching them what money is actually for. But money is not just currency, it's a tool. And like any tool, how to use it needs to be learned. One very practical way to begin is to give children a small job, not simply the household chores that are expected as part of family life, but a job that's paid. For example, they might help clean a room, take the rubbish out regularly, fold laundry, or some other small task that's genuinely useful. The key is that they're being paid for contribution, not simply handed money. Let's say they earn $5 a week. Now that's where the teaching really begins. Instead of letting that $5 disappear immediately into sweets or toys, you help them divide it into three simple areas or envelopes. The first envelope is the giving envelope. I love that that's listed first. How many of us taught our children to give? $1 goes here. That's actually 20%, which I think is quite a lot. I would have thought 10% would have been fine, but we can all make decisions about these percentages. At the end of the month, the child takes the money they've collected and gives it to someone who needs it. It might be a charity box, a local cause, or even helping someone directly. The lesson here is simple. Money is not only for ourselves. Wealth has a purpose beyond personal comfort. How many of us listening today have taught our children this? Not many, I think. The second envelope is the spending envelope, the fun one. $2 go in here each week. At the end of the month, the child can spend the money on whatever they like. No lectures, no criticism. If they want to buy something small and frivolous, that's part of the learning. Because the spending envelope teaches freedom and decision-making, children begin to understand that when money is spent, it's gone, and they learn to choose. The third envelope is the investing envelope. I'd like to point out that this word investing is different from saving in the energy around it. Investing in something is much more empowering, I think, than saving. Think about that. To invest feels different. It feels stronger, more intentional. It feels more expansive, actually. It's a bit like when people say, saving for a rainy day. Stop that. Change it and call it investing for an opportunity or investing in your future. Do you see? There's no feeling of fear or lack around that statement. There's no negativity around it. There's no expectation of a rainy day, and yet you have provided for just that if you should need it. Words are so powerful. They feed into our subconscious and they set up a blueprint there that runs underneath our lives. Okay, back to the invested $2. This is where it becomes powerful in terms of teaching your children. You as a parent match it with one additional dollar of your own each week. So the child's $2 becomes $3. I was going to say good luck if you can find that out in the marketplace, but we're talking about principles here. Over time, they begin to see that money can grow, it can accumulate, it can work quietly in the background. By the time a child reaches 10 years old, they will already understand three very important things that many adults are still trying to figure out. They will know how to give as an ongoing principle in their lives, how to enjoy because they feel free to do it, and how to multiply money. I'd just like to go back a little bit because spending often can have guilt attached to it that we shouldn't be doing that. But if you've already decided how much you're free to spend, it removes that guilt. So, they will have an investment portfolio, say by the age of 10, at just $3 per week, there'll be $780 there. Maybe as they grow up, they get given bigger jobs, they earn more money. Maybe you decide then to add $2 instead of $1 to their weekly investments. Now, beyond the mechanics of envelopes and coins, something deeper is happening here. That mind of your child is forming patterns. They're learning that money flows. It comes in through input. It moves out through generosity and enjoyment. And some of it is set aside so it can grow. I just want to add one little thing here. I say it comes in through input because I didn't want to say it comes in through hard work, because we all know people who work incredibly hard and still don't have enough. We have to stop saying work hard and say work smart. I'd just like to leave you with that thought. So they're putting aside some of their money so it can grow. And the body responds to this structure too. Children grow up with clarity around money. They hold their head up because they're managing it well. They experience less anxiety through their lives. Uncertainty about money is one of the great stresses in adulthood. We all know or see or have experienced that. Teaching a child how money behaves reduces that fear. You're putting them in control. And there's another deeper dimension. We teach children how to give, earn, invest, and we're teaching them responsibility. We're saying, you're capable of managing and growing your resources. You are capable of thinking about others. You are capable of good decision making. That builds character and confidence. Teaching a child about money is not really just about money, it's about stewardship. It's about understanding that resources carry responsibility, that generosity matters, that discipline matters, that wise decisions today create stability tomorrow. And when children learn those principles early, they carry them forward into adulthood. So the goal is not simply to raise a child who can earn. The goal is to raise a child who understands how to live well with generosity, enjoyment, and wisdom, and how to grow what they have. What an amazing principle to really have the privilege to teach to your children. Mine are grown up now, but I might have a go at explaining to them anyway. And actually, if you have grandbabies, you could do this with them. Pay them for a job they do for their parents. I hope that answers your question well, Julie. I think it was really important. Well, that's us for today. Thank you for your fine company. If you have questions, please do send them in to us at admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz or to me under the contact tab at margounlimited.com, Margo with a T. We always love to hear from you. We're going to finish today, as we always do, with the word, our message from the universe, aka God. And this one sounds just like him speaking to us. I am ever consistent with you. I am never up or down. I am never flaky or changeable. Know that I am the one true constant in your life, and you can always rely on me for that. You have dipped into a world of focus where you are spending your time and energy, but take time from that to simply commune with me. No questions, no answers, just you and me. That is a place of peace and balance. It is a place of wholeness and contentment. Faith is the door that leads to love. You seek love. Faith will take you there. I think that's amazing. Thank you and see you next time.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.